Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, April 3rd. The market rally continued, and this week there was some legitimate good news, particularly on the manufacturing end, as virtually all nations recorded a pickup in activity for the month of March, with purchasing managers' index readings generally in the mid-50s, with 50 being the dividing line between contraction and growth. In the U.S., the figure was a better-than-expected 59.6. But does this mean we are off to the races? Certainly Friday's employment report for March, a gain of 162,000 jobs, a little less than expected, though with fewer census workers figured in than guesstimated, doesn't exactly foretell this. The official unemployment rate, after all, remains at 9.7%. Far higher unofficially, while the number of long-term unemployed, defined as being out of work at least 6 months, surged to over 6.4 million. This is a tragedy with huge implications and costs down the road. The employment report also revealed that average hourly earnings declined, while earlier in the week we learned personal income for February was unchanged. So while many talk of big growth rates in terms of GDP the past two quarters, including the just completed one, I've been on board with PIMCO from the standpoint it's not about the past 6 months or the new quarter, it's about the second half and beyond. But where I deviate with my old friends and employer is that I remain fixated on geopolitical events that could change sentiment and kill the recovery in a flash. I truly believe this will be the case before the end of the year. I hope I'm wrong. For one thing, my portfolio isn't exactly positioned for Armageddon, something I need to address quickly. Not including my holding in natural gas as a play on a far stormier hurricane season. It's just that when it comes to the argument, as postulated by PIMCO and their ilk, whether or not the recovery is sustainable, I say it isn't, regardless of any flare-up with my hotspots or a large-scale terror attack, far more market-moving than Moscow, for example. I just believe that visibility in the second half has to be limited, though like you, I wait to see if the coming round of earnings reports provides further clarity. The global stimulus, emphasis on global, is winding down, after all, and at week's end, China's central bank kind of summed it up perfectly. In discussing its concerns over the potential for asset bubbles in all parts of the world, as well as certain industries, the People's Bank of China opined that, quote, ultra-loose monetary policies by governments around the world don't mean real economies have recovered or will recover strongly. Such gains, unless they receive sufficient support from macroeconomic fundamentals, may lead to a new round of asset bubbles that may burst. China, of course, faces the exact same issues as others do. When to cut the flow of money, seeing as it is an unbalanced global recovery. This is also where the issue of sovereign debt comes into play, such as with Greece. This week, needing to raise $21 billion by end of May, Greece rushed out $6.7 billion in seven-year paper, but the interest rate was 3.3% above the corresponding German benchmark, and then in the aftermarket went as high as a spread of 3.67%. This increases Greece's interest expense far more than they hoped for, given the government thought they had received a vote of confidence from both the European Union and the IMF over their budget-cutting proposals. But in the end, it was investors who needed to be swayed, and they weren't. Greece then tried to float some 12-year paper, and it was just as unsuccessful. It can wait for rates to come down, but maybe they won't, and Greece can't wait forever. But Greece isn't the only one with sovereign debt issues. Both the United States and Britain are two rather important economies that ratings agencies have warned face downgrades down the road should they not get their houses in order. Japan is a third. The U.S., though, has a number of problems. Robert Samuelson, Washington Post. Let's be clear. A budget crisis is not some minor accounting exercise. It's a wrenching political, social, and economic upheaval. Large deficits and rising debt, the accumulation of past deficits, spook investors, leading to higher interest rates on government loans. The higher rates expand the budget deficit and further unnerve investors. To reverse this calamitous cycle, the government has to cut spending deeply or raise taxes sharply. Lower spending and higher taxes in turn depress the economy and lead to higher unemployment. Not pretty. Greece is experiencing such a crisis. Until recently, conventional wisdom held that only developing countries, managed ineptly, were candidates for true budget crises, no more. Most wealthy societies with aging populations, including the United States, face big gaps between their spending promises and their tax bases. No one in Congress could be unaware of this. Robert Samuelson continues, so Obama is flirting with a future budget crisis. Moody's emphasizes two warning signs, rising debt and loss of confidence that government will deal with it. Obama fulfills both. The parallels with the recent financial crisis are striking. Bankers and rating agencies engage in wishful thinking to rationalize self-interest. Obama does the same. No one can tell when or whether a crisis will come. There is no magic tipping point, but Obama is raising the chances. That's Robert Samuelson, Washington Post. Erwin Stelzer, London Times, on the coming VAT, value-added tax. A 3% levy would bring in $300 billion a year, $280 billion if food is exempted. Throw in inflation of about 4% a year, the number the International Monetary Fund's economists are now recommending as a target to replace the 2% most central banks are using, and the deficit might just become manageable. But America would have been transformed. Government will be more intrusive. The health care bill provides for 16,500 new tax inspectors. I just have to interject, the IRS denies this in the interest of full disclosure, but I'm on board with Stelzer et al. To make sure that every American has health insurance or is paid a fine that by 2016 will come to $2,085 or 2.5% of income, whichever is higher. Emissions from not only coal plants but lawnmowers will be regulated. Standards by which schools will be judged, once set locally, will include federal rules mandating preferential treatment of minorities. Incomes will have been redistributed. The incomes of families earning more than $250,000 and of middle-income families will be taxed more heavily to fund programs for lower-income groups. And if the president has his way and persuades Congress to grant legal status to the 13 million illegal immigrants now in the country, the ethnic and cultural mix of the citizenry will have been changed. That would cost about $30 billion for the health care entitlements of this new group, but in the great scheme of things, Obama thinks this will be a small price to pay. It is, after all, not his money, for completing the transformation of America. That was Erwin Stelzer, London Times. On the healthcare front, it's sit back and wait time, as in wait for the unintended consequences. Items such as the Medicaid burden being foisted on the states at the worst possible time, which will result in a further increase in taxes for the locals. Medicare cuts never enacted, because they never are, which in turn explodes the deficit. All of the above argument by Samuelson and the IRS agent issue. Those who deny this last one will be the case are really missing the point. Someone has to police the mandates. I'm not, and I didn't think you'd want to. In terms of the news uproar over businesses quickly taking huge write-downs, Commerce Secretary Gary Locke wrote in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, "The new comprehensive health care legislation reduces costs for families and businesses and will significantly benefit American businesses by slowly and eventually reversing the tide of crippling premium increases washing over our nation's employers. These cost savings are real. They will grow over time." The new law contains numerous reforms that a 2009 study by the Business Roundtable, an association of CEOs of leading U.S. companies, says will help slow the growth rate of health costs over time. Okay, two things, Secretary Locke. One, why the heck should I believe you when you say the cost savings are real and they will grow over time? Second, you say the new law will help slow the growth rate, not reduce, but help slow the growth rate. That's the old congressional budget gimmick. Slowing the rate of growth is not a cut or savings. Corporations, you see, are forced by the SEC to immediately restate earnings to reflect the present value of their projected long-term health liabilities. That's why they're making the moves they are, Charlie Brown. So now that squirrely guy from California, Congressman Henry Waxman, is going to hold hearings too, as Rich Lowry writes in the New York Post, browbeat the affected corporations. This is naked political harassment. Lowry continues, citing the Congressional Budget Office, Waxman says his concern is that the write-downs appear to conflict with independent analyses. If he's genuinely surprised at the real world departing from CBO projections, he should brace himself for more shocks. Is he going to demand that OMB Director Peter Orszag testify when the projected deficit reduction doesn't materialize? Editorial, Wall Street Journal. In other words, CEOs who must abide by U.S. accounting laws under pain of SEC sanction and who warned about such write-downs for months are merely trying to ruin President Obama's moment of glory. Sure. Presumably, the White House is familiar with the Financial Standard Accounting Board's 1990 Statement Number 106, which requires businesses to immediately restate their earnings in light of their expected future retiree health liabilities. AT&T, Deere & Company, AK Steel, Prudential, and Caterpillar, among others, are simply reporting the corporate cost of the Democratic decision to raise taxes on retiree drug benefits to finance Obamacare. The journal continues, perhaps Mr. Waxman should move his hearings to the Syracuse Carrier Dome. The Towers Watson consulting firm estimates that the total write-offs will be as much as $14 billion. Any 3,500 businesses that offer retiree drug benefits are by law required to report and expense their losses this quarter or next. But 'twas a famous victory, Obamacare. Meanwhile, in two of the latest polls following passage of health care legislation, a Washington Post survey had 46% for the changes, 50% opposed, while a USA Today Gallup poll had 47% calling it a good thing, 50% a bad thing. I'd say that's pretty consistent. Lastly, J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon attacked the demonization of big banks by politicians in his annual letter to shareholders, which on one hand I don't disagree with, but then he goes on to say, quote, while bad actors always should be punished, we also should note that not all who got into trouble were irresponsible. No, Jamie, first off, the public is torqued off because no one really has been punished, and second, any of the industry's leaders who got into trouble did so because either they didn't get it, Dimon himself admits he missed the housing bubble, or sat back and watched while their house, their firm, burned. And then he says, it is wrong to assume that big firms inherently are risky. Banks shouldn't be big for the sake of being big, but scale can create value for shareholders and for consumers. Well, so here's the deal. The solution to this big bank too big to fail issue is simple. Increase the capital requirements in a big way and reduce the level of allowable leverage. Then the only other thing that needs to be done in terms of financial regulation is to regulate the hell out of the derivatives market and eliminate entirely credit default swaps. There, that would take about 4 or 5 pages max. Heck, it would take 3 paragraphs for everything but regulating derivatives, and for that we could run a short essay contest for, say, $50,000 to see who can do it most effectively in the fewest pages, $50,000 being a lot of money for a writer. As noted above, the rally continued for a fifth straight week, though once again the gains were minimal, up 0.7% for the Dow Jones to 10,927, up 1% for the S&P, and 0.3% for NASDAQ. NASDAQ's last 3 weekly advances have been 0.3%, 0.9%, and 0.3%, hardly the stuff of raging bull markets. Oil's rise, however, to the almost $85 level puts it at its highest level since October 2008. On the Treasury yield side, rates continued their climb, with the key 10-year up from 3.69% to 3.94% in just 2 weeks. Strength in the manufacturing numbers was one culprit, and then those who came to work on Friday in the bond pits pointed to job gains in the employment data, excluding the census workers, as being pretty good. We'll get more clarity when all markets reopen on Monday. Lastly, just some thoughts from Charles Schwab, founder and chairman of the firm that bears his name. He wrote of how low interest rates are squeezing seniors in an op-ed for the Journal. It's so true. Seniors who played by the rules, who diligently saved for a lifetime and had amassed a nest egg of $100,000, could count on an added $5,400 in retirement income per year. Back just 3 years ago, when the average yield on a one-year CD was 5.4%. That may not sound like much to the average Wall Street Journal subscriber, Schwab writes, but for a senior on fixed income, that extra money improved the quality of his life. Well, today that one-year CD is more like 1.3%, if you're lucky. Schwab goes on, many in this age group are being forced to stretch for income one of 3 ways. One is to take on more risk, just as they are progressing through retirement. Another is to go longer in maturity with their fixed income investments, locking them into a situation where inflation will bite further into their principal and purchasing power. And the worst is the slow erosion of principal that is already occurring as people cash out of savings to make up for needed income. The large banks are well on the mend. Profits are improving and they're doing just fine. Our seniors, though, are not. Those in Washington should keep their plight in mind as they consider Fed monetary policies going forward. Damn right, Chuck. That's all for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday, April 10th. In the meantime, have a very happy and glorious Easter and a great week ahead.